I'm Josh Robert, and welcome to another archive episode of Curtains at 8, originally aired September 10, 2003. Nick interviews Danville native Frank X. Walker, graduate from the University of Kentucky and Spalding University, educator, poet, and 2013 Poet Laureate of Kentucky. Nick and Frank discuss his book, Buffalo Dance, The Journey of York, a collection of poems detailing the experiences of the Lewis and Clark expedition through the eyes of York, a slave who made up part of the Corps of Discovery. Enjoy.
Genre artist Frank X. Walker.
Multifaceted. Yeah, right. Is that a compliment, Frank?
Multi-confused.
Multi-confused.
I'm just trying to be a true Gemini, I think.
I see. Are you a Gemini?
I am.
So am I.
All right.
Could be a long night, couldn't it?
I think the stage is already set.
Sounds great. We talk about your facets. Now, you are a poet primarily, would you say?
Today I'm a poet.
I'm a poet. That sounds like a poet, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's
today I'm a poet.
Today I'm a poet.
Yesterday, what were you?
Other.
And tomorrow?
Tomorrow. Whoa. Hopefully both. And I think that I really try to stay away from labels. I have this fear that I might get locked into one and locked out of something else. But I guess over the years, most people probably know me as a visual artist. And it's been about 10 years writing plays as part of a message theater back in the 80s here in I first began publishing as a short story writer. But I think I wrote poetry not to build a poetry because I couldn't afford a therapist. And the rest is history.
When was your first poem? When did you write that?
Actually, my first poem that I remember, I was a high school student, and I wrote a poem about the assistant principal that wasn't very flattering, but it was published in our school journal. It did, but nobody understood what it really meant. So by the time they figured it out, it was already in print.
You already had your degree and gone.
It was, my credits were completed. Yeah. I was guaranteed out the door, but not so welcome there for a while.
Nothing like being a safe muckraker, right?
Exactly.
School for you was where?
Danville High School in Boyle County, Danville, Kentucky.
Did you play football?
I did.
Well, I'm telling you what everybody did. Everybody in Boyle County plays football.
You don't have a choice.
And you play it very well, too, as a matter of fact.
We still do, you know. In fact, we play better than when I was there, but my brothers remind me of that all the time.
Okay, multifaceted. Poet, playwright, short story writer, visual artist. Tell me about your visual art, Frank.
Well, for a long time, it seemed even longer because I was a part-time student. I came to UK as a freshman in 1979 and kind of hopped around from engineering to journalism. And
as a man after my own heart.
And then jumped into studio.
What kind of engineering did you start with?
I started out with electrical engineering.
Oh, I started mechanical.
Okay. Yeah. We missed one. We're still doing pretty good, though.
No, that's all right.
And ended up in studio art. That seemed like the perfect home for me. I was trying to make sense of this desire to make art and to write. And it seemed a safe place. And then I ran into Gurney Norman and ended up in one of his creative writing classes. And
Gurney was just on with us last week. He is a bowl of fruit. He is terrific.
Absolutely.
I enjoy that guy. Well, just when I see him, I start smiling.
Everybody does. Yeah. I consider Gurney my literary father. In fact, he was probably the first person after high school that really convinced me that I could write and it was worth pursuing and developing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in his class that I made a decision to change my major from whatever to English so I could take more classes with him and other people in the English department. And it was his press that published my first book. We've had a
stylus or
25-year plus relationship that is still bearing fruit.
Yeah. The visual art, you started doing that in college? Had you done any of that before?
In high school. I think the curse started in high school. The only awards I won every year was in English and in visual art.
Mm-hmm.
Every year.
And that's why you went into engineering.
Of course.
Certainly. to broaden your vistas.
For the resume building.
Yeah.
I was also unfortunate enough to score well on the standardized testing. So everybody decided I should go into engineering.
Yeah.
And there were no scholarships available for writing or for art for me at that time. Mm-hmm. But there was a ton available for engineering.
You were probably an Ellis Scholar.
I've...
The Ellis Foundation for Engineering Students.
Actually, I was it was a short-lived GE scholarship named after, I want to say, the Vogel scholarship back then, but it was 1979. It only lasted a year. But it was...
You came to your senses within a year.
It was very educational. What can I say?
Sounds good. What sort of visual work and are you still currently doing?
Well, not enough. I think that I sustain my visual art desire and passion as a photographer because I don't have the time it takes to do what I used to do, which was I'll make wooden assemblages. You know, the last series I had was a series of slave ships that were built, all of, you know, hand-carved and machine-cut pieces that were put together, built, then painted to create a certain image.
How big were the ships?
The biggest one was 7 foot, 3.5 feet. The smallest one were about 2 feet by 20 inches.
Stylized?
More abstract as far as the design on the painting, but they, you know, very stylized as far as the figures. But they're really
representational sort of thing.
They were actually based on the blueprint of the actual slave ship from the Middle Passage. And I think I saw that enough times in the former life as a cultural center director on two different campuses that I really wanted to be able to talk about that particular part of history with young people and not have it be so painful. Whenever we brought it up and we looked at things in books, nobody really wanted to talk about it, but my desire was to create a piece of art that was beautiful, that kids wanted to touch and that allowed them to be in the presence of it long enough to have this historical conversation about what the Middle Passage was about. And and it worked. And then somebody saw it and liked it and asked for one, so I made a second one, and I kept making them.
It hasn't been long ago when it would have been nearly impossible to either make that kind of art or to have a discussion about it, from white, black, or whatever. Self-consciousness about the whole incident left us all sort of mute, sort of speechless, and I presume that your ships were part of the breaking of that ice.
I'd like to think so, you know, at least for me. You know, I think that a lot of art has the potential to be a healing force. And if nothing else, if it can start a conversation. A lot of my poetry has been criticized for not being solutions to the world's problems, but, you know, that wasn't their intention. If we make people have the conversation, then we've done our job.
A poet's observation is what I want to see.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
To talk about things like slave ships now, how do kids react to that, African-American kids in particular?
Well, I think it's still a very painful subject, but I think some things have happened, including the movie The Amistad, you know, more and more references to what actually happened in history classes. Because when I was a student, I remember that whole conversation happened in a paragraph, and it was just kind of glazed over.
You were basically in a traditionally white high school, I presume.
Yes.
And to have any mention at all was a far cry from my high school days. My commencement, not commencement speaker, but baccalaureate speaker was Governor Orville Faubus, if you remember that name from Arkansas, who was instrumental in trying to lead the fight for segregation. And so a lot of things have changed to the point where you were in high school, but now, is it open?
Well, I think it's more open. You know, I think that, and all the openness that has happened, I think another problem has been created. There are a lot of, feel so disconnected from the civil rights era that they think everything is fixed, you know, in the same way that because...
Fixed in what sense?
Well, you know, if you remember back when the issues in South Africa and apartheid was in the news every day, and it's almost as if when Nelson Mandela was released and became president, it fixed everything in South Africa. And even though it's not in the news every day,
I don't know that it's fixed in South Africa.
It's not fixed, and there are some massive problems that happened for people, particularly people on the lower economic scale in South Africa. But nobody knows about it because nobody talks about it because it's not at the forefront of the conversation. And I think in the same way, civil rights activity doesn't, you know, there aren't really major marches outside of Martin Luther King's birthday. You know, in Louisville recently, we had another police shooting. When I say police shooting,
that has gotten to be almost a stereotypical situation.
Well, it's almost an annual event.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been there 6 years, and there have been 5 shootings of African American males by white policemen, and with no consequences, other than there are a couple of marches, people complain, and then people tend to forget about it. I think the institutional memory of people is shrinking, and you know, once something is no longer on the front pages, people stop talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what happened with young people and the civil rights era, that they don't feel connected to those kinds of things. And I think that makes it easier for them to get their values from somewhere else.
Yeah, now what about yourself? You're sort of in the middle between the 50s civil rights movement and early 60s and today's youth that you say are disconnected.
Well, yeah, I think because I fancy myself as an educator, you know, I feel a certain responsibility to try to bridge that gap.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of my responsibility as an artist, is to let my art be a potential bridge to kind of close that gap, to let, you know, all young people be more educated about these things that I think are important. You know, I think that I tend to write mostly about social justice issues, family, identity, and place. And you know, I'm pretty comfortable with my role in Kentucky as a Kentucky artist and a Kentucky
mm-hmm.
writer, but I also know that the image people have of Kentucky is different outside the state. And I also know that people outside the state quite often don't even think there are people of color here in Kentucky.
They think we're all here with no shoes up in the holler someplace.
Well, they think that, and you know, I think it's even, you know, beyond that negative narrow stereotype that they believe in, that they also believe that there are no people of color here.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, both my grandparents and great grandparents are Kentuckians, and I always laugh at that notion, but feel a certain commitment to try to dispel that myth. But it always comes up when I travel outside the state and I have a chance to do readings and have conversations with the people.
They're surprised to see an African American coming from Kentucky.
Well, they're not surprised to see one because they've seen UK basketball on TV. But they're surprised that I'm from Kentucky and that I have a family here, and that, you know, I've had people ask me, where did I come from before I got to, 'cause they can't.
So it's a strange picture that people have of Kentucky.
I think so.
On issues like that.
I
found it to be the same when I was in the Air Force and traveling around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Same sort of thing held true one afternoon in the barracks with a bunch of Air Force guys waiting to go to officer training school. These were guys who had scored in the very highest percentiles of the qualification test, because at the time the Air Force was not taking very many officers. And they accosted me one day, one guy from New York City, one guy from Long Island, one guy, D'Onofrio, from Connecticut, and they essentially grilled me for a while because I was from Kentucky. And they really held the notion that we were running around barefooted here. They really did. I don't know why such a strong stereotype would stick. Anyway.
Well, yeah, if you think about, I mean, if you look at mass media and all the images that portray Kentucky or this part of the country, I think they perpetuate those narrow stereotypes. And they also, you know, you think about even TV shows like Dukes of Hazzard and Beverly Hillbillies, that people connect with us.
That was Georgia and Tennessee, though. We know that for sure.
Well, I
right?
mean, we say that, but I think in New York, they don't see a difference. It's all the same.
They don't. Ann Shelby also said that it's our own fault because we laugh at our own stereotype. You know, we kind of get a kick out of some of the hillbilly things and silly things that we do. But I guess in a way, that's all right, but it's not all right to be totally categorized, which is something that you're working against pretty hard.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much effect it's having, but.
Who coined the word Afro-Latchin?
I plead guilty.
That's a clever combination of words. Afro-Latcha. And it gave rise not only to some of your poetry, but you published and held some conferences under the term Afro-Latchin Poets.
Well, we actually have a writers group that began in the early 90s called the Afro-Latchin Poets, which we're very proud of, because when we look at our publishing history and how much of us have stayed connected to writing and teaching, between Nikki Finney and Kelly Crystal Wilkinson and Paul Taylor out in Washington State, You know, we've consistently published since the early 90s, and all of us are still connected to institutional, educational institutions, and have a commitment to developing the next generation of young writers. So there's a certain synergy there that I feel really good about, that had a lot to do with the energy we generated by deciding that the Appalachian Poets was a name we could stand on. And it really gave, you know, it did two things for us. It allowed us to have a kind of a rallying theme to stand behind. And it also made us visible, you know, in a way that we felt we were invisible before that term. You know, all of us were in Kentucky and writing, but we weren't organized in such a way that people recognized that we were even here.
And with the coalition of Appalachian Poets, then it presents more of a front, more of a symbol that people can relate to or relate more easily to?
I think so. I think, and it also gives us a chance to connect to something that's good, which is, in our opinion, which is Appalachia and the tradition of literature in Appalachia, mm-hmm. which is, in spite of the negative, narrow stereotypes, Appalachian literature has a very, you know, wonderful reputation outside the state, you know, around the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, by using that term, we can connect to it also.
I think it's great. Talking with Frank X. Walker, but your itinerary looks ominous.
Well, you know, it's a product of understanding that I have another full-time job, and I actually had to take a unpaid leave of absence to do the book tour. Oh. So I had to squeeze as much as possible into those 3 months.
Now, you're employed as?
I'm the executive director of Kentucky's Governor School for the Arts, yeah. and also a vice president of the Kentucky Center, formerly the Kentucky Center for the Arts in Louisville.
Why did they change the name from For the Arts just to Kentucky Center? Just simplify it,
and as a marketing ploy. I think that in the same tradition of the Kennedy Center
mm-hmm.
and the Lincoln Center, you know, we're now the Kentucky Center.
Okay.
I think that's the way we see it in Louisville, but I think, I don't know that other people have made that leap with us yet.
Sounds good now. So a lot of the appearances that you make, you're making, I'm going to say on your own time, but not in regular work time frames.
Absolutely. It's a combination of bookstores, schools, colleges, universities, community centers, public libraries.
What are you currently working on, and what are you currently speaking about at these engagements?
At each of these, they're all a little different. Most of them, I'm reading from the new book, Buffalo Dance. And some of the schools, I'm actually giving a lecture about York's role in the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Mm-hmm.
In a few cases, people still want to hear about Appalachia. Because they just found out about it, even though...
Well, the name is moving. It's still moving.
It's still moving.
Yeah.
And so it's a nice mixture. And, you know, we're very excited about an event happening in Danville. There's a group of organized, all of Danville, Boyle County reads the same book. And
Which book are they going to read?
Buffalo Dance.
Well, how about that?
So I'm really excited
about it. So you're getting a little respect in your hometown, too.
You know, and I
didn't
even score a touchdown.
That's hard to come by. I get to do some work in Danville at the Great American Brass Band Festival. I've emceed that for about the last dozen years or so.
It's a great event, isn't it?
It is a marvelous event. So there was employed?
Sometimes, but at least 10 times he was off.
What kind of work did he do, Frank?
Well, he retired from the American Greetings Corporation, but no, he's a contractor in his other life. Like a lot of the men in my family and women, you know, he's a tinkerer, as he would say. Likes to build things.
Mm-hmm. And are you like him? Is he like you?
I think I'm like both of them. And they fight over that. You know, the good things, neither of them claim.
I'm familiar with
My mom is probably the more creative of the two parents.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's probably listening, so I can say that, be asleep. But
tell us a bit about Buffalo Dance.
Well, Buffalo Dance.
And if you've got with you what I think you have, would you be willing to read a few pieces for us?
I would love to read a few pieces.
Well, tell us first.
Well, I think it's you know, the story about it is probably longer than the book itself. But, you know, a lot of people, including myself, when we studied Lewis and Clark in school, there was no mention of York. You know, I have to admit that, you know, this book project for me was partially out of him.
Having not heard of him?
Having not heard of him and having been responsible for operating in two different African-American cultural centers.
When did you hear of him?
For the first time officially about 2 years ago, Hassan Davis presented a Chautauqua performance that just blew me away. And I think I immediately wrote a poem about him after that one presentation. Then I had a chance to read that poem at the Filson Historical Society in Louisville, and somebody gave me a book that was connected to him. And after reading the book, I wrote
a book connected to York?
Yeah, a book connected to Lewis and Clark, and specifically, it was called In Search of York. Jim Holmberg had written the new foreword to that book, and he was there in the audience, and he gave me that. And, you know, I read it that weekend and wrote about a half dozen new poems. And at that point in the research, I found out where York and William Clark had been in Danville visiting Clark's nephews, which...
Who were actually from Harrodsburg, I think, if I got the whole lineage right there.
Well, there, that Central Kentucky connection is so strong. And then the mention of Danville just kind of...
Rang with you.
Just rang with me. And there was, at that point, there was no turning back. And I decided that I needed to know as much as possible about York. And I made a trip to St. Louis to the Westward Expansion Museum and brought about 20 books and videos and CDs. Mm-hmm. And just started into the research. And every once in a while, I would come up for air. But about 3 months after that, I felt like I had enough information.
Were you researching for poetry, researching for a story, for a novel?
I was researching to write more poems. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really, after I'd gotten about a half dozen and shared them with a mentor of mine who lives in Montana, Greg Pape, you know, he said, there's a book here and that I ought to invest the time in it and see what I could get from it. And I just, you know, what I would do is, I would read or watch videos at night and just go to sleep. And I write in the morning. I'm a morning person, so I think I would dream about everything I read, and I would wake up, you know, refreshed and rested, having dreamed about York, and I would just start writing things down. And
fresh fermentation on the mind, yeah.
Fresh. And, it became so regular. I really felt like that York would, you know, speak to me early in the morning and even wake me up and encourage me to write things down. So it took about 6-8 months to get them all out.
Once you did that, you had a pretty good composite of York?
I felt like I did.
Well, tell us about York just a little bit in descriptive terms, and then if you've got something to read, that'd be cool.
Well, the things that are important about York is that, you know, he was a large man, and, you know, in addition to being the servant of William Clark, he wasn't a field servant. You know, he was a personal body servant, which meant that things were a little bit better for him. He dressed better. He ate better. He traveled with Clark. And Clark, you know, was at least middle class and did a lot of traveling. He was fairly well educated, and he had a chance to see things that a regular field hand would not have seen. So he had a little better life on the scale of slave life, if there's even a good scale there. The thing about the trip was that in the historical references, particularly from Lewis and Clark's own journals, he hunted, he carried a gun, which was unusual for a slave to have a gun.
So he was treated as an equal with a role.
It seems like he was treated as an equal in those terms, particularly when they were on the journey. And beyond that, the Native Americans, in some cases who had never seen a black man, they treated him better than equal in some cases, and in some cases worshipped him and renamed him because he was larger than everybody else. He was
renamed him.
They had several names for him. One was Katanka, who walks like man. Buffalo,
Katanka,
who walks like man.
Yeah.
There was another tribe who referred to him as Raven, you know, because he was black as a raven.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But these were all terms of endearment because of how they felt about him. And when I started reading those kinds of things about York, knowing that he had been a slave, I imagine the impact of that on the slave mentality. And suddenly, you know, you've been you know, your entire life, he was about 30 years old, he had been denigrated for his physical features, and suddenly he's worshipped for the very same things. And he's away out in all this wonderful, beautiful landscape, you know, the Rocky Mountains, the Pacific Ocean, you know, 100,000 buffalo at a time, that he had to be overwhelmed. And then all of that is just wrapped up in the one important issue for me is that York, based on what we know about him, he was illiterate. He could not write. And Lewis and Clark and at least two other people were keeping journals and writing almost every single night on the journey, and he couldn't write things down.
What would you give, Frank, for a journal kept by York?
Had
there been one, what would you give for that?
There's no price for that. But I think because that thing needs to exist, that's what the collection is the entire journey in York's words, in his point of view.
Oh, read something for us, will you?
I'm
really anxious to.
The opening poem that imagines a York at the Pacific Ocean after a year and a half away from home, away from his wife, having watched everybody else write things down every night and reflecting back on his experience and being so overwhelmed and wishing he could say something to somebody about what he had just experienced. And he imagines that he's speaking to his wife. And this is a piece called Wind Talker. Words dressed in blackberry juice, laid on onion skin like massa do. If I could send a letter home to my wife, floated in the wind on wings or water, I'd tell her about Katanka and all the wide and high places this side of the big river. How his family, numbering three for every star in the sky, looked like a force when they grazed together, turning to the muddy Missouri when they thunder along faster than any horse, making the grass lay down long after the quiet has returned. How they don't so much as raise a tail when I come round with my woolly head and tobacco skin, like I'm one of them, making the Arikara and Mandan think me big medicine, Katanka, who walk like man. Today, we stood on the edge of all this, looked out at so much water, the mountains we crossed to get here seem a little smaller. As I watch fish the size of cabins dance in the air and splash back in the water like cheering plane, I think about her and if we gon' ever be free. Then I close my eyes and pray that I don't live long enough to see Massa make this ugly too. And that's the opening poem. And then it reflects back.
Frank X. Walker here on Curtains Today. You got to give us time to think. Okay. Wow. I'm blown away. I really am. I'm blown away not only by the supposition you're making of what he might have said, but also using the dialect. It really does bring it all back.
Well, I think that was the hardest thing for me because it's not the style I traditionally write in.
Dialect.
When people read this account, that they believe it's in York's voice.
It worked. Don't you think, Leela?
Mm-hmm. Oh, the collection's amazing.
Yeah. How about some more? I think I can stand another one.
You can stand another one?
Yeah.
A lot of what people don't know is that York spent most of his adult life in Louisville, Kentucky. And there now stands a 9-foot-tall bronze York overlooking the Ohio River, right at the Belvedere at 5th and Main Street. And the image on the front of the book is actually the clay image, the actual statue that stands downtown mm-hmm. in Louisville. And my friend Ed Hamilton, the internationally renowned sculptor who has another piece on the Mall in Washington, D.C., the only African-American with a piece of bronze sculpture in D.C. on the Mall, created that wonderful monument.
Fantastic. The book Frank refers to is Buffalo Dance, published by the University Press of Kentucky, which is why we're here tonight. And the title of the book is "The Buffalo Dance, The Journey of York." And York, of course, accompanied Lewis and Clark all the way. Okay, how about another selection, Frank?
Sure, I'm going to read a poem called God's House. And I start thinking about York didn't have a day timer or a watch to keep up with time. So
no Palm Pilot.
No Palm Pilot, you know, no satellite tracking system. So he really had to pay attention to everything happening around him. So in this collection, the landscape is a main character. And York develops a relationship with the landscape and nature. And it increases as the
Trip goes. As the trip landscape goes, changes all the
and
time.
And it changes and it becomes a bigger a character in the book. And this is introduces that. It's called God's House. And each poem is introduced with an epigraph that connects the reader to where they are on the journey. The book has a map in it even. So you can trace the trip from Kentucky all the way to the Pacific Ocean and back with this map, because we start the map at the Falls of the Ohio and near Louisville. When we first left Kentucky, the trees had commenced to dressing up the fall harvest, and the garden was already full of. Master Clark didn't ask me to go on no expedition. He just say pack and point it to the door. So I gather up what little I got and more than I can carry of his and head off to a sail-bearing keel boat where his friend Master Lewis is waiting. That boat was so big you could lay any 10 of the 16 men on board or 8 of me head to toe and still have enough room for the dog. We start out on the Ohio and swing up the Old Man of Rivers. When we gets to the mouth of the Dark Woman they calls the Big Muddy, we sets up winter camp a good canoe ride from St. Louis. That spring, when the rains come, we cross the Mississippi and commence to climbing the Missouri and float right up through heaven on earth. More sky than I ever seen, rocks as pretty as trees, and game so plentiful they come right down to the riverbank and invites theyselves to dinner. Now, I ain't what you would call a scripture quoter, but the first time I seen the waterfall at Missouri, felt a herd of buffalo stampede, and looked down from the top of Rock Mountains, it was like church. And where else but God's house can a body servant big as me carry a rifle, hatchet, and a bone-handled knife so sharp it can peel the black off a lump of coal, and the white man still close his eyes and feel safe at night.
Bravo, bravo.
Thank you.
Frank Walker, your poetry is fantastic. Of York is also. Where all have you read this publicly now? What kind of reaction are you getting from African-Americans, from Europe?
There are a couple, you know. I know as soon as I name one, I'll leave somebody out.
If there's any one.
I guess my favorite teacher in my entire time was my art teacher, Barbara Reinerson. And she had, I think she really helped me understand the importance of art. And, you know, I say art in the larger sense, not just visual art, but to say and to find some beauty in it and use art as an escape. And I mean, the power of art, she really made me understand. She had a saying that she always said that, you know, there's art in your heart. And when she first said it, I think everybody laughed at her and thought it was corny. But by the time I graduated, I really understood that, to the point that we all had to, as seniors, paint a tile to go in the ceiling. And on my ceiling tile, it said, "There's art in your heart." Her quote was on part of my little miniature mural that still hangs on the school ceiling in the art room.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
More prophetic than silly, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I was too young to understand then, but, you know, it really makes sense now.
Right. We've talked about York a bit and your book, Buffalo Dance, which is part of the Kentucky Voices series, which is being released, which is where you're going to be Sunday at Joseph Beth and all that. Tell me about York after the return. Now, you painted the last poem. You've got York with his masters, and everybody seems to get along very well, trust and all that. What were things like when he returned to, I'm going to use a bad term here, civilization?
Well, you know, I think that he probably thought things were more civil before civilization, because according to the historical accounts, everything changed when they arrived back. That when they arrived back in St. Louis, almost overnight, and possibly even before he returned, his was revisited upon him. And you know,
so he had to turn his gun in, his knife, and all that sort of stuff.
Most likely that, you know, there was.
Those were kind of symbols of manhood in the wild, and probably even still in Louisville.
Well, I'm sure, you know, this was the frontier then, to not have those. There's, you know, we found accounts where he was jailed for his attitude, because York really felt like he had earned his freedom because of his contributions towards the journey. And all the other participants, the official participants, were given money
and land. Independent of earning his freedom, experiencing freedom has got to have been a lasting memory.
Absolutely. I think, and I try to describe that from York's point of view in the book. There are several poems in the last third of the book that deal with that difficult transition after the journey, because one of the things that happened is that he insisted on his freedom, and he was eventually freed, but not till 10 years after the expedition.
Was he freed because of the expedition?
I don't think so. I think that according to Clark's letters to his brother, he basically, York had become too difficult. You know, he didn't think York would be of any use to him anymore. He'd become so
hard
temperamental
and hard to control.
To
work, yeah.
He was a bad employee.
Oh, man.
But, you know, he and towards the end of the book, there are several poems that actually start the poem with a quote from Clark about York's attitude. I follow up the same subject with York's point of view.
How about
I read one of those?
It's a good idea. You can catch Frank Walker at Joseph Beth Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And then Friday at...
Talks about York drinking, and York drinking a lot, and being jailed because of his kind of drunken...
This is after the
After they returned from the trip. And I want to explain that, you know, having some experience with those spirits and being a bourbon lover, you know, I think sometimes you can drink for good reasons. But there's a poem called Holy Water. Know what get in master's head and have him think a generous whip make me a better slave. About whiskey making ugly pretty, or drinking taking pain away. But what else put a song in your mouth when there be nothing left to sing about? What else let you laugh at the handful of salt rubbed deep into your own bloody flesh, make you forget how much you hates being alive, make you believe you can drown all your lost, all your fears, and wash away any thoughts of revenge? It seemed like the life of a slave is only the first parts of Easter. So I sprinkle myself, bare my back, and swallow. And there are a lot of religious metaphors in here that support, I think, the whole idea. You know, as far as we know that from slave narratives, that if slaves were allowed to read or not, they had some connection to having a chance to hear people read the Bible. And if they learned to read, that was always... a good way to being connected to the Bible on those rare Sunday meetings where there was a Bible present. So the themes about literacy and illiteracy are consistent throughout the book, because I think this is about words and about storytelling and about remembering and the importance of and the power of having access to being able to write and tell your own story. And part of York's desire to be free and desire to be a whole person and a whole man is a desire to also leave his mark in the world. And he says that in one of the poems, that he sees everybody else doing it. And it finally occurs to him that, you know, maybe this is something that would also be a way for him to express himself.
So how did he express himself? Once he's enjoyed freedom and he comes back to the oppressive situation, has difficulties there, what then did he choose as a path? Did he find a happy hunting ground? Did he find peace? Did he find a settled place that he could live with?
Well, there are two versions of the story. William Clark's account is that York died miserable after he had been freed, that he actually had asked to come back and be a slave again.
For support?
Because he couldn't, the idea of being free was just too much for him to handle. That was Clark's point of view. But there are several other accounts, including Native American versions, that say that York returned to the Great Northwest.
That's what I would have figured.
And lived to be a very old man. And in fact, in one story, he became a chief among the Crow Indians. And there were, you know, little Yorks all over that part of the West. So, you know, I think that, you know, what I wanted to do is to to respect his history's account and leave that kind of open-ended. But mm-hmm. I think it's clear that I suggest, you know, what I think.
You have true. You have a favorite choice, do you?
I do have a favorite choice of how his life ended.
Can you describe it for us in poetry?
Well, what I would like to do is read the next to the last poem. I think that last poem answers it too easily, but the next to last poem really sums up what I think York learned from his experience. And I think about slavery in general and York's growth. Because at the very beginning of the book, he's introduced as a character who is okay with his position in life. He has a pretty good position as a slave. But by the end of it, he wants to be a free man. He wants to be totally free. This is a poem called Cumulonimbus, which means storm cloud. What I come to know is no man born a slave, serving another for life, agreeing to be treated like cows and pigs and less, be something a slave weigh every day after he look at his other choices, death and running. Slaving ain't no picnic. We might look happy, but us grin mostly to keeps from crying. Old York say it takes something African to stand in the rain and smile while it's storming all around. He say nobody choose the slave. Them choose to hold on to what little family them got. Them choose to be sure somebody's still here to tell our side, to tell the whole story when it all said and done. What some calls lightning and thunder, just be God trying to see what we choosing and us grumbling about being slaves.
Go ahead and give us the finish. The coup de grace. I want to see how.
And the last poem is called Birthday. Clark West lived out his days as the chief among the Crow Indians. This is York. I reckon that made him feel bigger than me, planning that lie about me down of the cholera in Tennessee. He was part right, but what died wasn't no man. It was my desire to serve him, to still be his boy after all I done seen and done. His body servant sure enough passed on, but not below Kentuck. Every step to the ocean and back, every winter spent keeping him warm, knocked a little spring out of me. What he knowed is York died making his life easy, and was born again the other side of Rock Mountains, in the middle of a herd of woolly-headed buffalo, breathing mountain air so clean and cold, it make your ears fill up, your head try and float away, your eyes just turn to oceans.
Bravo. I wish we had a room full of people, Leela, to applaud.
I know.
Fantastic poetry, fantastic character. Tons of research has gone into this, at least.
A lifetime. You know, I think that there are a lot of things that I learned years ago that that made more sense once I got into trying to help York tell his story. And I think that his story is an American story. You know, we find so many great stories and movies from things that we invent from fantasy, and we have this, you know, real American hero that has a Kentucky connection that belongs to us, that, you know, we just have to, you know, if we had his actual journal notes, and if he had actually been a poet, these are the words that I believe he would have said. You know, this is, so my challenge was to try to imagine his hopes, his dreams, his wishes, his fears, and find the words for it and share that with somebody or everybody in a way that still respects history and respects the Lewis and Clark saga and the historical accounts that exist and we know to be true. And, you know, it's up to the reader to decide if I did that or not.
The reader he's talking about would go to the bookstore and pick up a copy of Buffalo Dance, The Journey of York Poems by Frank X. Walker, published by the University Press of Kentucky. It's fantastic.
Thank you, sir. You honor me by allowing me to be on your show.
Well, come back anytime. I'll cancel everybody else and put you right in there. That's what I tell everybody, though. How about a little music? What kind of music did you hear when you were doing your research for Buffalo Dance?
A lot of stuff. You know, I'm a big jazz fan. There are actually a couple of poems that have jazz titles. One of my favorite poems in the book is probably "A Love Supreme,"
mm-hmm.
and it's actually the poem. It's the first night that York and his wife are back together after 3 years of being separated.
On the trip.
On the trip. Yeah. So he's back, and he also knows that his master has plans to keep them separate, and he's moving to St. Louis, so they might not ever get to see each other again. So that night is even more special. So that's one of the connections, the subtle connections to jazz mm-hmm. in the book. But a lot of jazz, a lot of Native American flute music. You know, there's a whole middle section that just deals with Native American culture and history, and you know, in a respectful way that represents, I think, more positively their contribution to the expedition. Because for them, you know, it's not really a celebration. And when they think about Lewis and Clark meant the beginning of the end for a lot of Native American traditions and ways in existence. But they still want to commemorate the event. So a lot of those middle poems are prefaced by quotes from Native American chieftains and individuals who have rank in that particular culture.
So you're giving vent to yet another point of view.
That was my attempt.
Fantastic. Frank X. Walker.
Nick Lawrence with Frank X. Walker, originally aired September 10, 2003, and their discussion on Frank's book, Buffalo Dance, The Journey of York. Thank you for listening to another episode of Curtains at 8 on 91.3 WUKY's podcast. I'm Joshua Baer, and take care.